the Be Ninjas podcast, where you get an all-access pass to see what happens behind the closed doors of a fast-growing global bookkeeping and financial reporting business.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Be Ninjas podcast. And today we have David Ruddick, who is a cybersecurity expert on the show. Welcome, David.
Hey, Meryl. How you doing?
Great, thanks. And so great to talk to you. I know we met a couple of years ago now in a BNI group, and we've stayed in touch. And I know I've tracked some of the things that you've been up to on LinkedIn. And it's great to have you on the show and to have a chat. Before we get into cybersecurity, do you want to just tell our audience a little bit about who you are and the business that you run?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going to interject and say, yes, I've been stalking you on LinkedIn as well, and you've been doing some amazing things. But so I started the business 18 years ago. I was 22 at the time, and literally I just started doing IT support for a company. But about 7 years ago, we nearly lost the business. And I went to a business coach, and she said, you know, you need to focus on what you're really good at and use that as your niche or your calling card. And she said, you know, for those clients who really value or really looking for what you're looking for what you do, that will have value for you. And we'd always been very security conscious. It was just the way we were wired. I may have done some silly things during my youth, and that's a topic for another time. And so we started doubling down on cybersecurity. We saw it as a growing problem. And then sort of late last year, the Australian Computer Society thought we were doing a very good job because we were training all of our technicians in privacy law and cybersecurity and information security. And we won an award for that, small skills transformation for a team. And then I was interviewed for the Australian Financial Review off the back of that. And I made a comment that I couldn't see insurance companies continue to pay out on claims if businesses were being negligent. And long story short, we're now engaged by one of the insurance underwriters to provide incident response or cyber incident response to their Australian insured. So it's been a very interesting ride, but yeah, it's been awesome at the same time.
And that sounds like a fantastic opportunity with the insurance side of things. I'd like to dig a little bit into your business story as well. And so you talked about some ups and downs and also taking the business in a different direction. And at Be Ninjas, we really believe in finding a niche. And for us, that's bookkeeping and financial reporting, and also finding market segments within that to focus on. And I heard that you mentioned that in your own business journey, and that you worked out what you were good at and then decided to really focus on that. And you've done really well at building your profile as an expert and a cybersecurity expert. So yeah, what are some of the things that you've learned along the way in growing your business, and what does your business and your team look like these days?
Sure. I think like all of us, when you start out in business, you think you've got to take on everything if it's got a pulse because it brings money in the door, but it leaves you so fragmented. You know, you're spread between so many things. And I had a web development team at one point. You know, we were traditionally an IT support shop, but we were doing everything, you know, that would potentially bring business in. And you end up really spread thin. And I had a business coach turn to me and say, if you look at your GP and you go see them, and it might be $55 or $60 for a consult, and let's say that consult's 15 minutes, so they're turning over maybe $300 an hour. Then you look at your specialist, and you know whether it's an eye doctor or oncologist, all that sort of stuff, and they're probably charging $3,000 an hour. And the GP knows a little bit about everything, but the specialist knows a lot about one thing. And I guess that's kind of the same when it comes to business. You can be a jack of all trades, but you end up being very, very, you're a commodity, let's put it that way. Whereas if you focus down on something and really master it, then the people who value that skill that you have will seek you out and will be prepared to pay, a premium for that because you are the, I don't like the word expert, but I like evangelist, but because there's much more intelligent people than me out there. But you know it well enough that you can really do some good. I've now got, we went up to 12 staff at one stage before we nearly lost the business. We then rebuilt it with 3. We're back to 7. And I now have an IT services arm, which is the traditional thing we always did. And we've built out a cyber incident response / digital forensics team as well, which has been really cool because it's a new challenge. And I think our past understanding of small business technology has really helped us understand the incident response / forensic side of it, because the bigger firms like KPMG and that, they're not used to dealing with, you know, the small to medium business market like we are.
Yeah, and I think that's a really nice lead in to the cybersecurity conversation. But the first question that I wanted to ask you is, can you give us some examples of where you've seen things go wrong for businesses? So whether they've had some kind of threat, they've had data loss issues, and is there anything that they could have done to prevent this as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, there's a couple of categories that we're seeing at the moment as the main outcomes, I guess you'd call it, of a cyber attack. The main reason that people are actually calling on their policy. The biggest one is phishing emails that go around that trick someone into entering in their email credentials. And we're seeing a large amount of what's called business email compromise, or BEC. And basically what it is someone in your staff either falls for a phishing attack and enters in their email credentials, or they're reusing their password on multiple sites, and one of the sites that they use gets hacked and their password gets exposed. And as a byproduct, the intruder gains access to the mailbox and will typically sit in that mailbox for about 3 months. They'll look for invoices and payment information, and they're trying to work out who the players are in the business, who's responsible for authorizing payments, who's responsible for making payments. And we had a business a couple of months back brought to us. The financial controller's email account had got hacked at a point in time where they were about to transfer money to an overseas investor. The intruders interjected in the conversation and suddenly rewired the money to their own account by saying, this is our account details, please transfer here. And that was to the tune of $600,000. We saw another one just recently, same MO, but in this particular case, the mailbox they'd hacked didn't have any financial workflow attached to it. And so they then used that mailbox to then send another phishing campaign to everyone who was a regular contact of that mailbox. And you might think, well, that's a bit silly, but when we send emails to each other, there's a level of trust implied with someone's name. So if you're getting it from someone you normally would trust, there's a higher chance you'll open it. The other one we're seeing a lot of is when people do actually have remote desktop servers, like remote access systems, they're getting hacked and data's getting exfiltrated or stolen, and then ransomware's getting run on the systems. And it's at that point that a lot of businesses are learning how bad their backup strategy was.
Gee, so some of these things are a scary situation that sounds like it could happen to you or someone in your business. And I reckon the first example that you talked about, I've actually had colleagues that have spoken to me where they've received emails that were supposedly from the CEO or directors asking them to organise payments, and it just sounded a bit sus. And in both of the cases that I can think of, they actually flagged it and sent a text to the director or the CEO just to confirm, do you actually want me to make this transfer? And that's when they realised that the email had been hacked. But in the cases that you've described, is there anything that these businesses could have done differently to prevent these situations?
Yeah, look, 100%. So number one, and I know everyone who uses Xero, you just recently got forced to do this, enable multi-factor authentication or second factor authentication on your emails. Enable it on anything you can, because it significantly reduces the chance that that account will be compromised because you need more than just username and password. The other thing as well, before you make any payment, you respond to any email, pick up the phone. Takes 30 seconds to call someone and say, hey, did you send this? I am adverse to using SMS or to emailing. Definitely don't email them back because it's probably the intruder, but it is actually not that hard to steal someone's mobile number and you know, essentially get in on the communication as well. So I always say, look, just pick up the phone. The other one that we see a lot of is the sort of the invoice scams that come across on the same way. If you always pay your accounts based off what's in the accounting system, so you should have, you know, your vendor's bank account details stored in your accounting system so you can do your automatic transfers. If you get an invoice with someone with a new BSB and account number, give them a call. You know, have you changed your bank account details? I would try and insist that they send you on letterhead that they've changed their bank account details. And if you get an email or a letterhead that sends you those details saying, you know, we've adjusted our bank account, still call them. Hey, we got this from you. We just wanted to confirm that, you know, this is all okay. Because what we're seeing, I guess what people don't understand is the people who are doing these things, it's organized crime. 80% of it comes from organized crime. And you've got to think of a business, you know, even what you're doing, Marilyn, you and the team have really focused in on what you're doing. You've got a team of people who are doing audio editing for you, and you've got a team of people who are doing marketing, and you've got a team of people who are doing bookwork. These guys are compartmentalized. They've got teams of people who specialize in various aspects of cybercrime. They're very, very good, and they're constantly refining their method so that they can try and trick more people into doing it. So we need to be more vigilant and not as lazy, because that's how they're tricking us occasionally. And yeah, like I said, just pick up the phone and call someone and say, hey, I got this from you. Is it legit?
So you've made a couple of great points there, and a couple of things that I'm hearing are that you're not just dealing with one person. These are organized professionals that are trying to take information and not do the right thing with it. And then the other was really to pick up the phone and have those conversations and double check. And in terms of business owners who have a team of staff, are there any advice that you can, was there any advice that you have for the business owner around educating their team with things that they could be doing to protect their own data and the business data?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is twofold. One, there is a stigmata that if you put your hand up and say, hey, I think I've clicked on something, or I may have done something that has caused problems, that I'm going to get into a lot of problems. Someone's going to get upset with me. We've got to break that because you want your staff to quickly come to you and say, hey, look, I think I've clicked on something, so that you can take action if necessary. And so that's the first thing, is to create a culture where it's acceptable to say, hey, I think I've been scammed. The second one is getting staff on board with the fact that they are the defenders of your business information and your customer information. And if the business does enforce some sort of security policies, it's not because we're trying to be totalitarian and disadvantage staff from sitting on Facebook or whatever the hell it is, but it's really to try and strengthen the security posture of the business. But likewise, if you make the task of doing someone's job more difficult, they'll find a way to work around it. So you can't implement security controls that really are, slowing the workflow of the business down. But also vet your staff, vet your vendors. All of our staff have police background checks annually. We say to them that we'll do drug checks and all these other things as well. But your vendors, I just read an article, US CERT, Cyber Emergency Response Team, has notified people in America that their managed service providers, so people like myself who provide IT services or manage other people's IT systems, are now a major target. So if you're not vetting the companies you use who may have access to your systems, you're probably also setting yourself up for a potential attack.
That's a great point too. That's actually something we talk about with bookkeeping clients. If they're choosing between using a freelancer on Upwork or using a company like Beaninjas, we actually talk about that and the security measures that bigger businesses, I mean, we're still a tiny business, but that a business with a number of staff, the controls that they can have in place and the background checks and security. And so I think you've made a great point around looking at your vendors too and actually thinking that they might actually be a way into your business.
Oh, 100%. But you can be a small business. Doesn't matter how big or small you are. As I was talking to you about it just before the pod we started recording, we did a security assessment for a law firm who is totally cloud-based. They have no staff. They have no offices. They have about 20 staff in Australia, about the same amount of staff in the Philippines, about half a dozen in India, and et cetera, et cetera. And they asked us to do a security assessment. And I thought the biggest problem was going to be their staff in the Philippines, in India. And I learned, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners and yourself know, that a lot of the facilities that you use over there are biometrically secure. They have cameras on everything. Computers are locked down. And so the risk profile that we created for them was minimal when they're working at the facility. But it was actually when the offshore staff are home and they access the system, or the Australian staff who were just accessing it from any laptop, that we started to actually get quite worried. And so coming back to your point, if the business, you could have a business with 50 staff who just don't care about security, and you could have a business with 5 staff who have made, the trust is so important to them that they've invested in the right things, and that doesn't have to be expensive. And you end up with, Beaninjas who actually care about their customers so much that they've implemented the right things, they do all the proper checks, versus whether it's someone from, as you said, one of those websites, or even a big firm who everyone's just a number. And they really haven't taken the care to assess